This is an ABC podcast.
Gavin Prater-Pinney is a man who keeps starting these lovely, whimsical ventures that pit themselves against the busyness of modern life and the compulsively driven nature of our day-to-day existences. He starts them up, they become massively popular, and then they become seriously hard work after a while. Gavin's the co-founder of a British magazine called The Idler, which is provocatively devoted to, quote, restoring dignity to loafing, to idle pleasures. But The Idler became something of a phenomenon and a bit of a grind after a while. And so more recently, Gavin Prater-Pinney decided to set up something called the Cloud Appreciation Society. And to his delight, the Cloud Appreciation Society became massively popular. It has members all over the world. These are passionate people, and they have a manifesto which says, we believe that clouds are unjustly maligned and that life would be immeasurably poorer without them. We think that clouds are nature's poetry and the most egalitarian of her displays, since everyone can have a fantastic view of them. We pledge to fight blue sky thinking wherever we find it. Life would be dull if we had to look up at cloudless monotony day after day. Eventually, Gavin's cloud fascination brought him all the way from England to Queensland, to the Gulf of Carpentaria, to fly into a rare and spectacular cloud phenomenon known as the morning glory. Gavin Prater-Pinney is the author of The Cloud Spotter's Guide and a lovely coffee table book called A Cloud a Day. Hello, Gavin.
Hi there.
Can you see clouds from where you are at the moment?
Yeah, I'm actually inside a cloud right now because it's foggy outside. So, you know, here in the southwest of England, in Somerset, we've got fog. So, yeah, that's what it's like to be inside a cloud. We all know that.
Do you do this most days, look at the clouds in the morning?
I do try to make a point of paying attention to the sky. And it's, funnily enough, something you've got to remind yourself to do. Even if you run the Cloud Appreciation Society, I find, you have to sort of remind yourself to check in with the sky. But the fact is, I do remind myself, I tap myself on the shoulder every now and then and go, listen, what's going on in the sky? Let's just have a look. And then if there's something interesting, I watch it and I'm there for the moment. But it's not like you go out cloud spotting. It's just something you have. It's an attitude. You have it in the back of your mind and you've always got one eye on the sky.
My preferred times to look at clouds are in at dusk and when there's often a sunset involved, but also on a moonlit night, you know, when they sort of rake across the moon. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, sunrise, sunset are always going to be classic times to view the sky. I mean, who doesn't like a sunset? It's partly because of the colours, of course, these warm, rosy hues that you get at the beginning or end of the day when the sun's low on the horizon as a result of its long journey at a glancing angle through the atmosphere. But it's also often because those are the one times in the day, the only times in the day when the clouds are lit from beneath. So normally, we're just used to seeing them with the sun above, the sun shining through them. We're kind of looking at their bases that are maybe perhaps darker. But there's a moment at the beginning of the day, and it's maybe a few moments, like a few minutes, at the beginning of the day and at the end of the day when, if the sky's clear off on the horizon, east or west, wherever the sun is, then it can shine up onto the bases of the clouds above you. And just instinctively, we know that's momentary. It's fleeting, it's passing, and it's a special moment. So yeah, I mean, like everyone else, I love a sunrise and a sunset.
What memories do you have of staring at clouds and storms from when you were little?
My first memory of being conscious of a cloud was when I was maybe five years old, something like that. And I was being driven to school by my mother in London. She had a little sky blue Mini and we were driving to school and I looked out of the window and I saw one of those puffy clouds in front of the sun that was causing those beams of sunlight to fan out. I know now that they're called crepuscular rays, from the sort of term for twilight. But I don't know why that they're named after twilight, but they're called crepuscular rays. And that cloud I know now to have been a cumulus cloud, the solid looking one comes from the Latin for a stack or a heap. Cumulus is where we get the term accumulation. But at the time, I just thought, wow, what is that? Look at the way the light's just like an explosion. What's it made of, that cloud? What's it made of, and why does it stay up there? And those are questions I think a lot of children have. They're why clouds at a certain age, around that age, become fascinating for us. Funny thing is, a lot of us just stop asking those questions when we get older and we turn to adults, and we don't never necessarily got the answer. We just start taking them for granted because they're always there.
You have a theory in one of your books, which is one of the reasons why children become quite so obsessed with clouds, is because possibly because of their point of view from lying in a pram.
I don't know. That's based on zero evidence. It's not an empirical study that led me to that thought. But I do wonder, when you're really just beginning to process vision, you're just beginning to see the world, you know, the things that matter are the face of your caregiver, be that your mother or your father. And then whenever you're outside the rest of the time, you're probably gazing up at the sky. It's probably the only time in our lives when we spend a good proportion of our time gazing up at the sky as the day progresses. I also wondered whether the perspective of a child makes you think about the sort of associations with the clouds that historically we've always thought of them as associated with the gods, because we've always looked up to our gods, in just the same way that a little child looks up, physically looks up to her or his parents. And they are your gods when you're that age. So, you know, I've wondered whether that, of course, we know the sun's up there, and that's that deep down, we know that's the giver of all life. But, you know, I don't know. There's something there possibly to do with our looking up and finding something elementally important in life.
My son's earliest memory is of when we lived in an apartment quite high up and watching a storm, a monsoonal storm, roll in across the city. Do you have a memory like that?
I used to live in a block of flats in London, and we were fairly high up, and my bedroom had a kind of view out across the sort of cityscape to some degree. We weren't in central London, we were on the edges, but the cityscape to some degree. And I remember when there were storm clouds. There wouldn't have been the size of storm clouds, perhaps, that you were used to in parts of Australia. But I remember looking out and seeing the lightning and hearing the thunder, the rumble of thunder, that first realization that the two don't happen at the same time. You see these flashes of lightning, and then there's that pause and moment of the thunder arriving. Yes. There's that moment of build up. So there was that, the bolts of lightning, maybe beneath the cloud to the ground, or cloud to another cloud, or whether they were within the cloud, therefore making the whole cloud sort of light up in a more diffuse way. We call it sheet lightning. It's just when the lightning bolt goes from one part of the cloud to the other part of the cloud, and it just all lights up because it's sort of hidden within the cloud, as it were. And I remember watching the drops of the rain weaving their way down the glass. So I do have vivid memories of watching storms when I was young, yeah.
And there's something delicious about watching a storm up high in an apartment, watching all that drama and mayhem while you're warm and safe and dry.
That's right. And especially when you can sort of, there's the cold of the window, your breath against the window. It's really evocative.
Like I said at the beginning, the origins of the Cloud Appreciation Society begin with you finding that the Idler, the magazine, had become a bit like hard work. And so you went to Rome. Why was Rome the place where you got the idea to think more about clouds and maybe do something about clouds?
Yeah, well, going to Rome from London was just, I'd never lived in another country. I thought, we'd been doing the Idler for 10 years. We thought, my friend and I, who we ran it together, we thought, well, we'll take a break for a bit because we're doing 10 years. That's how we'll sort of mark our 10-year. We'll take a sabbatical break for 6 months. And we'd been doing commercial work as well at the side. So I was single. I was unencumbered. I'd saved money from doing this commercial stuff. And I could do an apartment swap with my apartment in London and one in Rome. So I thought, yeah, I'm going to live somewhere abroad. And I went out there and had a fantastic time. I was learning Italian. Wasn't really giving myself any big things I needed to do when I was there. And so it was a step outside of the routine in a, like a dramatic way. And one thing I found while I was living in Rome was there's a lot of blue skies. I mean, you do get fantastic storm clouds, like we were talking about just then, fantastic big building, you know, mountainous storms in the sky. But a lot of the time, not so many clouds. And at first it was like, yeah, this is so different from the UK. This is exotic, this weather. But then after a while, I was like, I feel like I'm missing something in the sky. I'm missing that sense that each day when I open the window, I look out, it's a new page to read. It's, you know, what does the day bring today? There was something just a bit too predictable about the sky. So that got me wondering. I also did, however, see a lot of clouds indoors when I was in Rome, because every church you go into, these Baroque churches, perhaps I'm talking about, on the ceilings of the churches and the cupolas, there are these voluminous clouds. Yes. That are the sofas of the saints. And everyone's reclined on them, looking down on the congregation below. So, you know, it's like the clouds were like nowhere and everywhere at the same time. And then just got me wondering about clouds. It got me thinking about them in a general way.
Were you missing clouds? Is that what you're saying?
I think I was. At first, I wasn't. At first, it was a novelty. And then I realized, actually, what clouds bring is novelty. They bring variety. And so, yeah, if you're somewhere like in the UK where we get a lot of clouds, we get a lot of low cloud coming in off the Atlantic the whole time, then to have blue skies for extended duration in a reliable way, that is a novelty. But that novelty, like everything, it's only a novelty for a bit. What I realized was the more enduring novelty, at least for me, more enduring variety is to embrace the clouds, not to think, oh, you know, they're here the whole time, but to look at them in a different way, to look at them afresh and realize actually they bring a new page each day to read. They bring variety and drama to the sky. And that got me to appreciate them more consciously than I had before.
So you'd been thinking in Rome quite a bit about clouds, about their presence and absence. How did these thoughts evolve once you went back to London?
So I came back and got back into the sort of swing of things back in London, and I was talking to people and chatting to them a lot about the sky and how I thought the clouds are an underappreciated part of nature. And perhaps the reason for that is because they're always there. You know, whenever anything is always there, you become blind to it. In particular, you become blind to its beauty. And I felt that was really the case with clouds. They dominate half our vision. And yet we think of ourselves as creatures of the ground, because I guess evolutionarily, we've always had to pay attention to what's happening on the ground, because we never really got attacked by birds. We got attacked by animals jumping out from, you know, bushes. And also our food is down on the ground. So we think of ourselves just as wired into us to think of ourselves in terms of the ground. What's going up in the on up in the sky, perhaps just we're not hardwired to pay so much attention to it. So it just becomes this background. And I felt this part of nature that is so dynamic and so evocative and has like a, you know, like we have in the manifesto, it's got a poetic quality to it.
If clouds only arrived one day of the year, I think we'd treat it like fireworks. We'd take the day off, we'd go out and we'd spend all day looking at the clouds.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, if they would, you know, and then if you had a really good one, it would be talked about for generations. It is definitely related to just how commonplace they are. And something can be so everyday, so commonplace that we don't really notice it any longer. Because again, evolutionarily, we are hardwired to notice things that change, because they're the things that kind of matter, in inverted commas, to you know, our survival and so on. So something that is sort of constant in its changeability, like the sky, it becomes just blurred out in our attention. So I came back thinking all of that, thinking that it's a little bit of a shame that they get such a bad rap here. I mean, I don't know what it's like in Australia, but here in the UK, they get a bad rap. I mean, you know, we have in the English language some negatives All right, someone's under a cloud when they're down. When there's bad news, there's a cloud on the horizon when there's bad news in store. It's written in the English language to have slightly negative connotations. And it's possibly because the only time we do notice the clouds is when they get between us and the sun. They cast a shadow which changes the appearance down here on the ground. And so we just think of them as the things that get between us and the sun, between us and the life force of the sun, the obstructions in life.
How were you then persuaded to speak up on behalf of clouds in public?
So a friend of mine was starting a festival, a literary festival in Cornwall, which is down in the southwest tip of England. She said, why don't you give a talk about clouds? I said, I haven't written a book. She said, doesn't matter. You know, we're just starting out. We're desperate for speakers. This was the second time they'd done it. The first year, I think they had probably a few more speakers than they had audience. So second time round, she was like, come and do a talk about clouds. And so I was like, okay, yeah, I could do that. I mean, I've never given a talk before, but I can sort of find out a bit about them. I certainly have the sort of passion, and that's what's going to drive it. So that's the important bit. So when we were trying to decide what to call the talk, I thought, you know, I've got to give it a good name. I'm going to call it the inaugural lecture of the Cloud Appreciation Society, just because that's the talk I'd want to go and see. It's just a kind of weird name for a talk. I gave the talk. It was totally full. So it obviously worked, that name. And then afterwards, people came up to me and said, great, how do I join? I'll join your society.
So now you're back into work again. So you thought you had to start a society after this lecture, inaugural lecture, had received such a response. How did you set it up and what could you offer members of such an august organisation?
Well, you've got to have a number, actually. People love a number. They all say they don't. They say, I don't want to be a number. But if they have a number, they know how early they joined. Do you know what I mean? So you can be an early adopter if you've got a low number. So I thought the first thing you do is you get a certificate with your name on it and a number at the bottom. It's your membership number. You also get a badge and occasional newsletter. It's developed a bit since then. But right at the beginning, I did it for free. I wasn't really thinking of this as anything other than just a fun idea. So it's pretty low commitment initially.
And how lovely. How many members has it grown to now?
54,000 now.
Oh, my God. Really?
Yeah. Right. I know, in 120 countries. We've got a good number of members in Australia. The country with the most members is the United States at the moment. That's where membership is growing fastest. I don't know why. I think I've got some theories as to why, but I think it's partly because of the sort of inclusive nature of a society that talks about the sky. You know, we all inhabit the sky. I talked about us thinking of us as ground beings, but of course, yeah, we live on the ground, but we live in the sky. The sky is an ocean of gases, but it does behave in many ways like the ocean of waters that we all sort of so familiar with. You get waves in this ocean of gases that is our atmosphere, and the clouds reveal those. But we happen to inhabit the bed of that ocean, and we all share it, and we all know what we're talking about when we talk about the sky. I could sit down with a sheep herder from somewhere in Mongolia. As long as we could just get the language right, we would both be able to have a good conversation about the sky, talking about cloud formations we know about, sunsets, etc. Not so many subjects, even about nature, that you could do that with someone from a very different culture like that, because, you know, plants and animals are going to be different in our different locations. The sky is generally, it's all the same vocabulary that we're talking about. So that inclusive quality of that sort of universal appreciation of something that we all share, I think, has resonated in the US, particularly recently, because of the divisive nature of politics and the divisive nature of the digital world. It seems to kind of polarize people, doesn't it?
I realize there's so little I know about what a cloud is. What is a cloud? Is it's water, right? Is it only water? Is that all it is?
It is effectively water, either water droplets or ice crystals. So the low clouds, clouds like the fog outside me right now, or the low cumulus clouds that are the ones you see on a sunny day, the fair weather clouds, the bright white individual clumps. So those are water droplets clouds. High clouds, like clouds called cirrus, which are named after the Latin for a lock of hair. Cirrus is a curl or a lock of hair. Those are the ones that look like brush strokes across the blue, you know, wavy streaks. Those are made of ice crystals tumbling from the upper reaches of the troposphere. And then you get clouds in between, which are maybe a mixture of the two. The large storm clouds are definitely a mixture of water droplets, ice crystals at the top, and everything in between. And then huge balls of ice if it's a hail storm cloud. So, yes, it's water, but it doesn't look like a glass of water. And that's because the water, of course, is in tiny particles. And whenever anything transparent, like water, is in lots of little bits, it's got lots of surfaces. So the light shining onto it gets scattered in all directions. And that appears white to us. It's why snow looks white. It's why the foam on waves looks white. It's why the hairs of a polar bear look white. They're clear, they're transparent, but they're hollow, and the light bouncing off them makes them look white. Anything where light is scattered in all directions, that's why frosted glass looks kind of milky white rather than transparent, because it's got a rough surface. So that looks white. So they look white to us because of that scattering. And effectively, it's water droplets or water or ice crystals, but you need little particles in the atmosphere for the water droplets to start condensing onto. They can't just go from nothing to droplets in the air. They need to get started on something. And so you also need a little more subtle ingredient, which is some particles of dust or minerals or organic particles of plants, something in the air, and the air is always freighted with these particles, too small for us to see, for those to be present in the sky, onto which these droplets or ice crystals can start to condense or freeze.
Since the water, no matter how tiny its droplets are, since those droplets, by definition, I suppose, are heavier than air, why do clouds stay up in the sky by and large? I mean, not today around your place, they're hovering close to the ground, but what's keeping them up in the sky? Why don't they just fall to earth like rain?
I mean, it's certainly a good question. I mean, that was the one that was on my mind when I was five. It's not necessarily obvious, is it, even when you're a grown-up? The point is that we think of a cloud as a thing, right? Average one, if you were to take all the droplets of water and put them in together, it would weigh the same as about 80 elephants.
Wow. Right?
So yeah, there's a lot of water in that cloud, a lot of liquid water in that cloud. But, of course, it's not a thing. We see it as a thing because of this reflective quality. The way it scatters the light makes it look like something solid. When the sun's shining onto it, it's bright white. When the sun is shining on from the other side of a cumulus, it looks dark and shaded. So it looks like a thing, but it's not. It's just a trick of the eye. It's a collection of countless tiny, tiny things, these droplets, or perhaps for higher clouds, the ice crystals. And so each droplet, you know, the size of a pinhead or smaller, that is easily wafted in the air. A cumulus cloud forms on a column of air rising off the sun-warmed ground. We call it a thermal. And this column of air you can't see, but it's lifting up. It's what glider pilots use to gain altitude and what hawks use, you know, and to circling within the thermal. This rising column of air off the sun-warmed ground, as it rises, the air expands and cools. And that is what causes usually a cumulus cloud to appear, if conditions are right. So that lifting air, that's easily enough for the tiny droplets to be wafted up with the rising air too. And, you know, even if the droplets are falling, they're falling slowly through the air because the air resistance is great compared to the tiny weight of the droplets. So actually their buoyancy in the air it's nothing special. There's nothing unusual about it. The unusual thing is their appearance, that they look like a thing rather than a bunch of teeny things.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
Gavin, for about 15 years, I lived in Brisbane, and the climate there was so different from the temperate zones where I'd previously lived. In Brisbane, it's semi-tropical, and that meant that suddenly clouds were a real thing that you really had to pay a lot of attention to. And so sunsets were quicker but more spectacularly beautiful, with clouds turning orange and purple. But then in the monsoonal period, you could look out the window of where I was working and see this gigantic grey cloud coming over the city with this greeny, sludgy tinge around it. It was almost like looking at ocean water up in the clouds. Now, this is something called the cumulonimbus, isn't it? Tell me about this cloud and what you know about it.
The cumulonimbus is the queen of the cloud world. It is cloud royalty. It's the storm cloud, the one that produces thunder and lightning and hail. And in particular, when it has that greenish tinge to it that you were describing there, that's usually when it is a hail-bearing cumulonimbus cloud. It stretches high, high up into the atmosphere. In fact, it stretches up to the part of our atmosphere where clouds can climb no higher. It is known as the tropopores. It's the top of that bit of our atmosphere called the troposphere, which is the lower part where weather happens. And up at the tropopores, the kind of profile of the air temperature changes a little bit, so it doesn't get colder any longer as you climb. It starts remaining the same temperature, maybe getting a little warmer, and that has the effect of being this invisible lid on the vertical growth of clouds. So this enormous storm cloud, the one that is, in fact, the tallest of all the clouds, climbing higher and higher in the sky, it gets to a point where it can't climb any higher and it can only spread outwards. And that is why this cumulonimbus cloud has a distinctive anvil appearance. You don't see it when you're down beneath it. So if the sky was darkened when you were in Brisbane, you wouldn't be able to see the shape of the cloud. You'd just see this dark, dark base that is, you know it's about to absolutely pour down. But from a distance, someone looking maybe from 50 miles away, would be able to see the clouds spreading out at the top, going ice crystals up at the top, so having a kind of like a sort of wild hairstyle at the top as it spread outwards. That's the classic cumulonimbus appearance. Cumulonimbus capillatus, it's called. Capillatus means hairy, because it's got this wild hairstyle, like, you know, a cloud that's had a bad hair day.
As this cloud would start to loom and rear up, there'd be this feeling of dread and excitement. My producer at the time would have to rush off home to let her dog in because it would get terrified by what was about to come. And the green tinge nearly always meant hail. Sometimes hail the size of golf balls, sometimes cricket ball size. It would get to that, wow, that size. But then once it unburdened itself of its load of its massive amount of water that would come crashing down along with the hail as well, there's this great feeling of relief and exhilaration that comes with it. I don't think I ever knew clouds could make anyone quite so emotional as those clouds can.
There's also there's the physical thing of the clarity of the air afterwards, isn't there? Because air looks much clearer after there's been a rainfall, because I talked about those particles being what the droplets form on in a cloud. You need something to get started on. But also as rain falls, it does also has this kind of, it picks up, sweeps up some of the particles in the air as it falls. So you get this clearer air afterwards. It's like a metaphor for emotions. Clouds are such strong and evocative metaphors for our feelings and our ideas. Like a cloud forming in a blue sky is like an idea forming in an absent mind. And the clouds pass over us like emotions pass over us. It's all, I think, to do with this sort of fact that they appear from nowhere. They come from nothing into existence. And maybe for a cumulus cloud, it then dies after a life of 15 minutes. So they're gone again. And we see these creations, formation and dissipation over and over again. It's all simply because of the special quality of water being the only substance on our planet that can be found in the solid, liquid and gas states within the temperatures of our atmosphere. It can change so easily between those three. One of them is invisible, the gas form of water. It's just one of the gases of the air, water vapor we call it, and it's in, you know, every breath you breathe out, Richard, has got water vapor in it. You don't see it. You can see it when it forms into a droplet or forms into ice crystals. We see them as a cloud up in the atmosphere. And so, because it can change so easily between these three states, water, it's in this constant dance between visibility and invisibility. And that, I think it is that simple fact that makes clouds these brilliant sort of metaphors for emotion and for kind of the imagination.
These clouds, these cumulonimbus clouds, these gigantic monstrous storm clouds are something that pilots always seek to evade flying around it or over it. Tell me the story of what happened to a US jet fighter pilot, Lieutenant Colonel William Rankin, who tried to fly over one of these beasts in 1959.
Yeah, he was a US naval pilot, and he was in his jet, in his summer flying jumpsuit thing, flying over the top of them. He had his weather report as he was going off on a training mission of some sort. It's a fairly standard day. He flew up quite high because he was in a jet. He could go up high because he knew that there were storm clouds in the vicinity. So he's going to go, oh, no problem, I'll fly up over the top of them. Went up right up there near the top of the troposphere that I was talking about. And then he had a problem when he was right over the top of one of these enormous cumulonimbus storm clouds, the fluffy upper reaches of that cloud beneath him. He had a catastrophic engine failure. Like all the needles on his dashboard just went boom down to nothing. it was so catastrophic that there was nothing to be done. It was not like he could sort of sort it out in any way. So he knew very quickly, right, this is an ejector seat situation. And he ejected out of the plane.
And what happens with the change of pressure once that happens, once you eject yourself from a plane well above the height that most passenger planes go at?
Yeah, you've got two problems. You've got pressure and you've got temperature. Temperature was like minus 50 degrees, something like that. I mean, it was incredibly cold. It was also very low pressure. And he said as he was falling, so initially the parachute doesn't, it's an automatic parachute, so it was designed to open at a certain altitude or other. So initially he's tumbling and he's spinning through the air, and he looked down at himself and his tummy had expanded so much as a result of this difference in pressure that he'd just experienced, and he looked like he was in an advanced state of pregnancy. And so he's falling down towards the icy upper reaches of this cumulonimbus storm cloud, knowing that this was not going to be good because it's not like he's falling through clear air. You have these enormous up and down drafts of air within a cumulonimbus, huge, powerful, rushing forces of air upwards. And in other regions of the cloud, the air is coming tumbling downwards, perhaps being pulled down by the precipitation. He fell into it and then he couldn't see what was going on, spinning around in the icy upper reaches of this cloud, incredibly cold. He was at this stage vomiting from the pressure differences. He was unsure whether his parachute was going to open because he was becoming so disorientated as he spun in all directions. It got darker and darker as he entered the cloud. As he went deep into it, less and less of the sunlight was able to penetrate and reach him. The surroundings, if you imagine a fog getting thicker and thicker and thicker until it's darkness. And then he started to feel the hail. And he said it was like being pummeled by a cage full of screaming lunatics hitting him, the hail. And then he fell further and further, and he eventually he had no idea what altitude he was at. And then eventually he felt this tug that his parachute had opened. And he thought, right, I'm going to survive now because this parachute has opened. And then the thunder and lightning started. And he said it wasn't like thunder. It was an explosion, because that's what thunder is. It's massive expansion of the air. It was an explosion. And both his eardrums burst from the power of these explosions of the thunder. The lightning lighting up his parachute above him. He said he looked up at one point, thought he had died. It was like a cathedral above him, the parachute, lit from the bright flashes of the lightning. Eventually, after being hit and pummeled and exploded around for this time, he emerged from the base of the cloud. He eventually landed in some trees, got his parachute tangled in the trees, but managed to get out. And all he had was a broken leg. He managed to crawl to a road and got picked up, went to hospital. The doctors were amazed that he had survived. And he had timed when he ejected from the plane, as a good pilot would, to have some idea of when he was going to hit the ground. But of course, he lost the sort of knowledge of what was going on. But once he landed, he looked at his watch again. Normally, that descent from that altitude would take 15 minutes. It took him 45 minutes because he'd got stuck inside currents of air. He'd been stuck within this kind of fierce churning belly of the enormous king or queen of the cloud world.
We mentioned right at the start, you're going to the Gulf of Carpentaria to witness the phenomenon that is known as the morning glory. Can you describe this, what it is, and what it was that attracted you, made you want to travel so far and travel for so long just to see this specific cloud phenomenon, Gavin?
So it's a roll cloud, all right? A roll cloud is a bit like what it sounds. It's a long tube of cloud. It's not like a vertical tube like a tornado or anything like that. It's a long horizontal tube. And the morning glory cloud, which forms on the Gulf Savannah region of northern Queensland, the area is famous for this one roll cloud that comes in the springtime, end of September, beginning of October time is usually when it comes. And I'd seen it in a book. It looks like this long tube stretching from horizon to horizon, quite low in the sky. And I said, wow, I knew about roll clouds before, but this is like a really dramatic one. You can see them on satellite photographs. They stretch like almost across the length of the Gulf of Carpentaria. So it's hundreds of miles long. What intrigued me and made me think, wow, wouldn't it be amazing to go and see this cloud, was the fact that glider pilots congregate to surf the cloud. Just like regular surfers on ocean waves, they're surfing the wave of air that this roll of cloud forms in the middle of. And so it's a traveling wave, an independent wave of air that travels across the Gulf of Carpentaria. It forms over the Cape York Peninsula to do with colliding sea breezes, and then it travels, this disturbance travels through the night across the Gulf of Carpentaria and arrives at the coast first thing in the morning. That's the morning element to it. Glory is named after the feeling of elation that people are supposed to experience when it passes overhead. I thought that's cool. And the fact that glider pilots go there to surf this cloud, I thought that's amazing as well. And I managed to persuade a newspaper here in the UK to let me write an article about it. I persuaded Qantas to pay for my flights. I managed to get out there without really thinking about what might happen if it didn't show up. Because I was there for 2 weeks. There was a lot riding on me seeing this cloud. But once I got out there, I was there for 2 weeks and I was waiting around. And it was blue skies every morning. I'd go out onto the savannah in first thing in the morning at daybreak and look to the eastern horizon, look for a line on the horizon, which was the first sign of this wave arriving. It travels about 35 miles per hour, something like that. So, you know, it comes and takes a while to get to you, and then it travels over and moves on.
So you waited 2 weeks for this phenomenon to finally arrive, living as you were for a couple of weeks in this little tiny town of Burketown, which is some 20 k's inland from the Gulf, population 178. I just wonder how much of a test this was of your commitment to being an idle person, being able to be idle for 2 weeks in a tiny town with a pub and a sandwich shop in it.
Yeah, pub, post office, cafe. That's it. That was what was on offer. But it was really, I loved it. It was great fun meeting everyone in the town. Everyone's super friendly. There were some glider pilots who were also hanging around waiting. So I wasn't the only one waiting. Everyone's sort of used to it because it's the morning glory cloud is one of the things there. Barramundi fishing is the other reason people come to Burketown. But this time of year, yeah, but the morning glory cloud was the reason. So they're used to people waiting around in the pub. And there were a couple of signs around town that they said I should look out for. In the pub, the beer fridge, the glass mists up a bit when it's humid enough for the cloud to form. The other one in the cafe, the tables, which are like laminated on top, not underneath, they curl a bit with the moisture. So they said those are the two signs to look out for.
It's the breath of Forex, the god of Queensland. They're breathing on the glass, telling you, go forth, my child, and experience the wonder. So that was the hint, seriously, was like frosted up window on the beer fridge.
I didn't have any luck until right halfway through the second week, getting quite stressed out by this stage. And the glider pilots were saying, yeah, it's quite common. You know, we're here for 2 weeks, having driven our gliders and the four-wheel drive, towing it all the way here, sit here for 2 weeks, doesn't show up, call up work, say, look, I'm going to have to take another week off. And they go, all right, then stay for another week. Still doesn't show up and you leave. And then the next day it arrives. And that happens quite a lot. And I was like, oh, God. But eventually it came. It was this amazing thing. So the glider pilots go up, they ride the front, the invisible rising air at the front is where this sort of air is lifting in this traveling wave. The cloud, the roll of cloud traveling along, lifting at the front of the roll, dipping at the back, is an indicator of where the wave is. So that shows them where to position their gliders and to ride great distances and at great speeds over this remote savanna terrain below with the winding rivers. It's incredibly dramatic, and really being up there with the sunlight shining over the top and this golden sun shining over the top of this enormous snaking tube of cloud stretching off to the horizon. It was an amazingly dramatic sight and experience. I'm not a glider, but I went up in a little Cessna with the door taken off, actually, so I could film it. I made sure I had the seatbelt on. And it was an amazing experience for anyone, let alone a cloud spotter.
Yeah, we couldn't have you toppling out of a Cessna. You know, he died for his clouds would be on your gravestone and all that. That's just too silly for words, isn't it? Could you see the end of them? Could you see where they ended, or was it just going on as far as the eye could see?
Certainly from the ground, it was as far as the eye could see. From up in a plane looking down onto them, it's quite hard. It depends. They vary from one day to the next. Once they start coming, you usually get like a run of them. They're incredibly dramatic, long formations.
Being the kind of person you are, you're inclined to think of clouds poetically, as I'm sure a great many of your Cloud Appreciation Society members do, whereas meteorologists, of course, think of them scientifically. Is there much overlap there? Can you talk to one another? How do you get on, you and meteorologists?
We do have a fair number of meteorologists and, you know, cloud physicists who are members of the society, just as many as we do, you know, landscape painters who think of them in a very different way. The two ways of looking at the sky are just flip sides of the same coin. People who are on one side of that coin appreciate us bringing them a view of the other. So for a meteorologist or scientists who work in weather, they like the fact that we're talking about the poetic and perhaps the sort of artistic side, the literary side. And then people who are perhaps learning to paint and realize and have heard quotations from people like John Constable, the romantic English painter who said the sky is the chief organ of sentiment in any painting, the keynote, what brings feeling to a landscape painting. They appreciate learning some of the science. We see our role as remaining right in the middle between those two ways of looking at the sky and trying to skip from one to the other as much as possible.
As you're saying that, I'm thinking of Joseph Turner's paintings as well, where the sky is absolutely the star of most of his paintings. And I was also thinking of when I was a kid and you draw a picture of a house, it's not until you draw the clouds that you go, it's done, because the sky seems to demand it.
I know, it feels like no child's drawing is quite complete without some clouds floating above. And they always tend to be cumulus clouds, the puffy ones.
And there's a whole other discussion topic there, which is that whether the cloudlessness of Los Angeles has caused mass derangement. I'm just putting that out there. I don't know. I don't know the answer to it myself. It's been such a joy speaking to you about clouds, Gavin. I've so enjoyed this conversation. Thank you very much.
No problem. It's been great speaking to you too, Richard. Thanks for having me on.
Gavin Prater-Pinney is the author of The Cloud Spotter's Guide and a coffee table book called A Cloud a Day. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Hi, I'm Andy Matthews.
And I'm Alistair Trombley-Birchall.
And we're here to remind you that The Pop Test, that comedy science quiz show from Radio National, is back. Each week we pick a science topic and ask comedians and scientists important questions like,
why might you stir your tea at 28,000 RPM?
Where on earth does time travel the slowest?
And what's so suspicious about being left-handed?
With guests Sean McAuliffe, Claire Hooper, Cal Wilson, Dr. Alan Duffy and Sammy Shah.
The Pop Test. Hear it now on the ABC Listen app or almost anywhere you get your podcasts.